and planetary threshold. So we have to have the foresight to transform ourselves before we actually get into a situation where the Earth system is out of control.
Yes, foresight. That's what we need. So you have advised the Australian government in various ways, and lately Australian politics have gone further off the rails towards more coal development and climate denial. Meanwhile, as you say, farmers in New South Wales are allowed to shoot kangaroos because the drought is so awful. What now for Australia?
Well, I think we're actually, if you look at Australia, Australian society is somewhat in a complex systems view. We're getting much more variability now in the system. Over the past 10 years, we've gone from prime ministers who've vigorously supported action on climate change. We put in a meaningful carbon price. That got overthrown. Now we're going through a succession of prime ministers at an increasing rate, mainly because of the climate change issue. That's the underlying thing that's destabilizing politics. But at the subnational level, we have some really positive signs. States like South Australia are already over 50% renewable. Our own little Australian Capital Territory, which is sort of the equivalent of D.C. in the U.S., will be 100% renewable in about 18 months. And we've done that over about 8 or 9 years. So, and that's a city of about 500,000. So you can transform really fast if you put your mind to it. And I think Canberra's crossed a tipping point where now, although there was a lot of angst about how much it would cost to get carbon out of our electricity system, now we want to get carbon out of our entire territory economy by 2045. And it's got widespread support, no problem from the Treasury and economists. So I think we've crossed a tipping point to realize we can actually do this. And it's actually going to benefit us in other ways in addition to the climate benefits. So I'm hoping that things like this, that these social tipping points can come in time to help us get on the right pathway.
It sounds like people and the local governments have just gone ahead well past what the retrograde national government is doing, and that offers some hope for the United States as well.
Indeed. I think that's a good example, too, in the United States. And there's probably a reason for that. I think the big vested interests that want to maintain the fossil fuel world operate at the big levels in governance, operate at the nation-state levels, whereas people who actually understand the risks and feel the impacts already today want to get on with solving it. And the best thing they can do now without getting the national governments moving is to get moving at the local level. And that's happening around Australia, too.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
All I would say is make one more point to your listeners. Often people, when I talk about this paper and other aspects of my work, they say, but you know, give us hope. Can you please give us some hope? And my answer is, actually, you make hope. People themselves make hope. And that's what we've done in Canberra. We've got a much better attitude toward this problem because we're actually going out and doing things and making a difference. So my response to people is, you can do something. And the best thing you can do is get active on this, change your local politics, try to change your national politics. That'll generate hope.
We've been speaking with Dr. Will Steffen, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University and part of the Climate Council of Australia. He's the lead author of a new paper, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. It is available in full text for free, and you can find links to that, plus some quotes and comments, in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Will Steffen, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
One of my climate heroes is Dr. Hans Joachim, or John Schellenhuber. Early on, Schellenhuber dared to ask the question, what if we go beyond 4 degrees C of heating? There were two conferences on that. The first was at Oxford. I broadcast Schellenhuber's speech from the second, held in Australia. You can find that program and my detailed notes on his speech in my show blog at ecoshock.org. It's still important. In his 2011 speech at the 4 Degrees or More conference in Australia, Dr. Schellenhuber revealed something that always made me wonder. He said studies in physics show the temperature is unlikely to stay anywhere around 7 degrees C. Simple calculations about the wave patterns of matter suggest the temperature would either rest around 5 degrees or keep migrating up to 10 degrees hotter, where there is another natural plateau. The later 2018 paper also talks about possible rusting points based on the potential energy system. It's deep stuff, and Schellenhuber is one of the top physicists, so I believe him. Find links to my radio broadcast of that keynote speech in my show blog at ecoshock.org. If we push the planet into the track for hothouse Earth, it will be due to crossing planetary boundaries. These are the so-called tipping points, where large natural systems begin to release more greenhouse gases than we do, and more than the current climate system can tolerate. Here is my Radio EcoShock interview with Johan Rockström, the Swedish leader of Planetary Boundaries.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. There are limits to what humanity can do on this planet and still survive. Johan Rockström has led a team that mapped out those planetary boundaries. Rockström is the executive director of the Stockholm Resilience Center. He teaches at Stockholm University and holds many roles in the scientific community. We'll talk about his latest book, written with Matthias Klum, Big World, Small Planet. Johan Rockström, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and a great honor to be with you.
One boundary set by world governments in Paris was to avoid heating the planet 2 degrees C above the pre-industrial levels. Some scientists say 2 degrees of warming is already built in. We're heading into the danger zone. Do you agree or disagree?
No, I agree. You know, the planetary boundary science, which is the basis of the book Big World, Small Planet, concludes exactly in line with what you're saying, that the climate planetary boundary in fact is even lower than 2 degrees Celsius. We put it at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the aim that the Paris Climate Agreement in the end really, really set out for, which means that it aligned itself with science. Now, the drama here is that we have already warmed the planet with an average temperature rise of 1 degree Celsius, but a lot of science indicates clearly that we are very soon, if not already today, committed to almost 1.5 degrees Celsius because of all the heat which is stored in the ocean and because of the cooling caused by air pollution, which is a paradox that actually air pollution, which destroys the health of people, is actually helping us by cooling the planet by basically shedding away incoming solar radiation. So we are probably close to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and we're moving very quickly towards 2 degrees Celsius. So yes, there is a danger zone there. However, there is a lot of evidence on the plate today showing clearly that we can transition towards a decarbonized future faster than we had previously thought, thanks to the ability to scale economically attractive renewable energy technologies, from photovoltaics to wind power to biomass to different forms of, you know, hydro and even nuclear to some extent, which can allow us to transition quickly. And what science also shows very clearly is if we want to settle at around 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, meaning below 2 degrees Celsius, we will not only have to decarbonize and leave the fossil fuel era behind us within, you know, 30, 40 years, we also need to transition into a phase in the second part of this century where we have negative emissions, meaning we take out more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than we are emitting into the atmosphere. And this can be done by working both with nature, using biomass, for example, plants and trees that take up carbon dioxide and transform it into charcoal and plug it back into the soil, or through different kinds of geoengineering systems, which we call carbon capture and storage, where you backplug technologies and coal-fired plants, for example, to suck out carbon dioxide, concentrate it, and suck it back into the crust of the Earth. So even though it's absolutely true that we are in a very dire situation and there's an urgency, there is increasing evidence that a transition into a world below 2 degrees Celsius, below the climate planetary boundary, is actually doable, even though the situation is challenging.
Under a high emission scenario, if we don't make that, I have seen maps projecting wide bands of deserts around the subtropics in this century. You are known for in-depth research on water resources and how to farm with less. Can we cope with changes to agriculture under climate change?
Yeah, this is a very important question. Now, and there are two parts of answer. I mean, one is where you started off. You're absolutely right. We are following a pathway, if we continue business as usual, if we do not implement what we have now promised from heads of state of all the world's countries to do in Paris, then yes, we would be first hitting right through the ceiling of the climate planetary boundary of staying under 2 degrees, and we would very likely take us to 3-4 degrees Celsius, which can be described in no other way than being a disastrous future for humanity, from the drought-prone agricultural regions in the center of the U.S. all the way to the tropical, vulnerable countries across Africa and the low-lying island states in the Indian and Pacific Oceans that would have to be evacuated even. So yes, that would be a very dangerous scenario, and the number one victim is everything that depends on fresh water, and among those is really food production as the first victim. But on the other hand, we can see, as I mentioned earlier, the possibility of transitioning in line with the Paris Agreement to avoid those most dangerous outcomes, meaning that passing 2 degrees Celsius, it would still require clearly major investments in adaptation. Remember that the last time we had 1 degree Celsius warming, and when the planet finally stabilized itself after that disequilibrium caused by 1 degree warming, we had on average 6 meters sea level rise on Earth. So, you know, we're very likely, even if we wouldn't reach that high level of change, to be forced to invest heavily in dealing with the rising frequency of droughts, rising frequency of heat waves, rising frequency of disease, and an irreversible increase in sea level rise. So, you know, however we twist and turn this, we will have to adapt to unavoidable change, but we have to avoid unmanageable change.
Now, at a TED talk, Johan, you told an audience that climate change may not actually be our greatest challenge. What did you mean by that?
Yes, and that is scientifically supported, even though I recognize how provocatively it can appear, because, of course, the global climate crisis is debated and at the center stage of our focus, and, of course, it is a major, major challenge. However, we are at the sixth mass extinction of species in the world. We are, therefore, as human beings, killing off everything from pollinators to large predators like tigers and cod and sharks at a pace equivalent with a global mass extinction. Among these six mass extinctions, by the way, is, for example, when we lost the dinosaurs some 65 million years ago due to an asteroid catastrophe. So we are in a very, very dire situation with regards to losing biodiversity. Now, remember that losing species on this Earth is not a moral issue just to protect everyone's right to exist as living beings. It is really our toolbox to allow ourselves to have a good well-being on this planet, because we need biodiversity to, you know, capture carbon, clean water, have good quality of air, and to produce food. So there's no other way than, you know, maintaining nature to have a good future. Now, the dilemma is the following. These are two crises, biodiversity crisis, climate crisis. However, the climate crisis has a perfect substitution. We can follow the conventional economic theory to say, okay, we recognize that oil, coal, and natural gas is too dangerous, it's too costly, and therefore does not deliver. And moreover, we're reaching a situation with peak of cheap fossil fuel sources, such as oil. So we transition into a substitute and therefore can deliver modern energy supply through solar voltaics, wind, biomass, hydro, nuclear, and other innovations. This is what economic theory has always as the way we can move towards innovation and development. And we're seeing evidence that this can be done. So we actually have a solution which moreover can deliver for human well-being. How is it on biodiversity? Well, you see, there's no substitute. You lose a species and it's gone forever. There's no regret period. You lose fresh water, or you run out of fresh water, there's no alternative. So biodiversity and what we call the living nature, fresh water, land, biodiversity, has no substitution. There's only one way and one solution, which is to safeguard the natural capital we have. And that is much tougher because it requires that we understand the need to preserve what we have to allow our children and future generations to thrive on Earth. So that is why I'm saying that perhaps we might find in the end paradoxically, that the climate challenge is the easier one because we actually have a substitutable, economically viable solution, while biodiversity is a much more complex and spread and deeper and fatal outcome.
Johan, what is the fourth industrial revolution and what could that mean?
Yeah, so this is both a great excitement but also a concern if we, so to say, allow it to live on its own. The fourth industrial revolution is the notion, which is backed up by more and more evidence and coming not least from the great innovation powerhouses in the U.S., from Silicon Valley to MIT and then the great corporations you have in the U.S., showing that we are right at the verge, as we speak right now, starting a new exponential journey into the digital revolution going to scale in the world, nanotechnology, biotechnology, allowing us to truly be able to think of a world where we can achieve basically abundance for all in the world by taking a major step in terms of delivery of goods and services thanks to or because of technological advancements, and that this is going very, very fast. Now, that is good news. It allows us to move and take a major next step into a modern future in the 21st century. The challenge, though, is the following. We know, if you look into the past, that essentially all technological advancements have accelerated our journey towards unsustainable development. It has sped up our ability to undermine resources and ecosystems and climate on Earth. So if an industrial revolution is allowed to occur on its own, it could actually accelerate our journey towards hitting these planetary boundaries even more severely. So our hypothesis in the Big World Small Planet, what we're suggesting is that a fourth industrial revolution has to be capped by planetary boundaries. And perhaps surprising to many is that our very deep conviction is that that would not halt the industrial revolution. It would rather deepen it even further. You know, if you say, oh, it's not enough to be really, really superbly innovative when it comes to the next generation of vehicles or next generation of aviation or next generation of smartphones, they also have to now be entirely sustainable, possible to recycle, and occur within a safe operating space. I believe that that would deepen the innovation even further and make us even smarter. So there's no contradiction between planetary boundaries and the fourth industrial revolution, but it's an exciting but also very challenging moment.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the Swedish scientist Johan Rockström. In your book, Johan, you say we can trigger a new wave of sustainable technological inventions to solve our ecological crisis. I just talked with another well-known Swede, Alf Hornborg. Alf says there is no technical solution to the problems of technology. We need social and ideological change instead. What are your thoughts?
Yes, and I know Alf Hornborg very well, and he raises a very important issue, and I'm so glad you bring this forward, because it's absolutely true. There's no convincing analysis to show that technological breakthroughs alone can take us towards a sustainable and equitable future with 10 billion co-citizens when we're a big world on a small planet. In fact, the pace by which we need to decarbonize our climate system, share the remaining rare earth metals, produce more than 50% food to feed humanity on existing land because we cannot expand into virgin ecosystems anymore. We cannot empty the oceans from more wild fish because we're running out of fish. These insights force us to recognize that technology can take us a certain part of the way, but we also need behavioral change, and that requires value change and particularly equity change. I mean, it's equally dramatic that we are a rich minority, some 1.5 billion of 7.2 billion people, who has caused the bulk of the global environmental risks on planet Earth. And it's equally, you know, acute to recognize that that minority is equivalent to the inequity challenge we're facing with, you know, a small percentage of the world's population owning more capital than 50% of the poorest in the world. So it's absolutely true that we have to combine a fourth industrial revolution not only with a deep sustainability mindset, but also with a deep equity and values mind shift, and that all of this will require from us all a sense of behavioral change and lifestyle change, which has to be founded on the recognition that we have to share the remaining ecological space on Earth. But I really want to emphasize that that ethical dimension and this lifestyle change, there's no evidence to suggest that that's a sacrifice, that this is, you know, moving backwards. It's rather moving forward into the future. And I really want to remind ourselves that the real sacrifice, the time we would really have to give up on our lifestyles, is by continuing business as usual. Because business as usual is what all science shows will take us across tipping points, which would undermine our ability to have good lives. And therefore, the most dire sacrifice to our lifestyles is by continuing as usual. A sustainable future is so to say, the only pathway that could plausibly give us the room to allow ourselves to have a good future. So, you know, you have to combine these issues, but recognizing that a modern, thriving future is today basically prerequisited by a sustainable framework.
Well, given our situation, what are the most urgent problems we need to tackle first?
Well, our conclusion in the Big World, Small Planet is that we have two major, let's say, urgent transformations we need to accomplish. And the first one is, not surprisingly, to bend the curve of emission of greenhouse gases and move rapidly towards a decarbonization of our entire world economy, which means leaving fossil fuels behind us. The number one issue is to halt all use of coal and coal-fired plants, deregulate or stop using oil and natural gas and move into renewable energy technologies. That is de facto an urgent challenge we face. And the second one is to transition into sustainable food production in the world, because it may surprise you that agriculture is the single largest cause behind us threatening planetary boundaries. Food production is the single world largest emitter of greenhouse gases. Agriculture is the single world's largest consumer of fresh water, the single world largest polluter of our waterways due to too much nitrogen, phosphorus, and chemicals, and the single largest loss of biodiversity. So sustainable food means a healthy planet. And moreover, which is quite interesting, is that sustainable food can also unlock many of the strategies towards more healthy diets. So I would say that the two most urgent challenges is to move towards a renewable energy future and a sustainable food future. And that would take us a long way in terms of a future within planetary boundaries.
And there is a program that you're involved in called Future Earth. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yes. You see, the planetary boundary framework, which then lands scientifically at the conclusion that we now need to define the Earth system processes that regulates the stability and resilience of the Earth system, and that we have to quantify biophysical boundaries within which we can have a safe future on a stable planet. All that evidence arises from 30 years of extraordinary advancement in global change research, what we call Earth system science, which simply put is the science of understanding how the Earth operates and also how we humans interact with Earth. Now, that science started in the 1970s and has progressed in a number of large international programs, from the World Climate Research Program to something called the International Human Dimensions Program and the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, looking at land and climate and atmosphere and interactions with the world economy. Now, some 5 years ago, the recognition was that now we have so much evidence that we're facing this urgent need to transform the world towards a global sustainable future, that this enormous advancement in Earth system science needs to take a next step, needs to basically integrate social natural sciences, and needs to focus more on science exploring pathways for a sustainable future. And after a long consultation among scientists across the world, with stakeholders from business and policy and civil society, the result is Future Earth. So Future Earth is a step up of the global sustainability science community, from climate change to biodiversity to economics, to start and really address the integrated challenges and opportunities facing humanity to transition into a global sustainable future. And Future Earth has just started. It has, interestingly, a distributed headquarters where the U.S. is one of the hubs for the global leadership based in Colorado with a number of top scientists across the U.S., one hub in Sweden, one in Canada, one in Japan, and one in France. And Future Earth has the objective of being, you know, a science platform for collaborative research, searching solutions for humanity's transition towards a stable and resilient future.
For your book, Big World, Small Planet, you didn't team up with another scientist, but with a fairly famous photographer. You started talking about the role of beauty. What has beauty got to do with science and policy?
Yes, this might be surprising that a scientific conclusion after 30 years of Earth system science, combining, you know, linking climate science to complex research on ocean acidification, lands at a conclusion that a key message to humanity is that if we can safeguard the remaining beauty on Earth, we stand a very good chance of a prosperous future. And that might be surprising, but, you know, there's something fundamental here, and it is about the collision between emotions and the rational, between brain and heart, represented in the Big World, Small Planet with the science that we summarize and with the photography that Matthias is displaying. But our conclusion is serious, which is that we live in a world of rising cultural and religious and political turbulence. And we focus so much of our efforts on everything that is so different between the Muslim world and the Christian world and the North and the South, etc., and all the divides we have. But our hypothesis is that we have a universal value. We have a universal value across every culture, every nation, every corner of this planet, which is that every individual has a relationship to his or her nature at home, and that this nature is what we define as beauty, and that if we can safeguard the beauty we know, and if we all can do that, we stand a good chance of that adding up towards safeguarding the beauty of the planet. So if you look out of your window, what do you really care for in nature, be it your closest tree or a little meadow or, as I have, just a little rocky spot on the coast of the Baltic Sea outside of the island where I live, these are fundamental, valuable, not to say prerequisites, for us to have a good planet that can continue to deliver human well-being. So the point is that, you know, coming back to this fundamental core of sustaining the beauty can be a key part of our mind shift towards a sustainable, innovative transformation in the future.
I have to agree, it's beauty that powers me and keeps me going even in difficult times. From Stockholm, we've been speaking with Johan Rockström, one of the world's preeminent natural scientists, I think I can say. Johan is co-author of the book Big World, Small Planet. He's the executive director of the Stockholm Resilience Center and teaches at Stockholm University. You can find links to his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Johan, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to this very important program.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Why is there such a rush to get out new vaccines for emergency use in the pandemic? Because millions already died from COVID around the world. In the United States, with over 3,000 deaths a day, nobody could wait for more testing. As you heard in this program, the climate situation is the same, and perhaps even more urgent. The United Nations just said every country needs to declare a climate emergency, no matter what else is going on. Even if our society and economy are teetering on the edge of collapse, so are our chances for a decent future. We need weather that humans, our crops, and all the species can live in. Everything is at stake. This is live or die stuff. We must all find out what the danger is and what we need to do to stabilize our home planet. I'm Alex Smith. Follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We go out with Change by the Canadian group Thistle.